From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Our program this week will focus on the new regulations from the Obama administration about gainful employment. Hi, this is Casey Green. I'm the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. So welcome all. Ahead of our conversation, please note you can post your thoughts about these conversations on the comments section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. And again, we're going to focus on a final pass at gainful employment regulations from the Obama administration. This week, the administration released a new set of rules for gainful employment, regulations which reflect an effort to address poor quality vocational education programs at colleges that often leave students with questionable credentials and substantial student loan debt. But as with past proposals to regulate for-profit colleges, the new regulations remain controversial and are almost certain to confront legal challenges. Moreover, even as some 1,400 for-profit post-secondary programs serving more than 840,000 students would fail under the new rules which go into effect in 2015, consumer advocates and some policy analysts call the new regulations weak, while advocates for the for-profit sector argue that the new rules protect community colleges, discriminate against for-profit institutions, and will deny many low-income and minority students access to post-secondary education opportunities. Joining us for this conversation about the new gainful employment regulations are Ben Miller, Senior Policy Analyst at the New America Foundation, Vicky Charay, Senior Vice President of Regulatory Affairs and Public Policy at Bridgeport Education, and Doug Letterman, the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Doug, let me turn to you to open this conversation. What do we need to understand about this second effort at regulations for gainful employment?
Well, Casey, thanks, and thanks to Ben and Vicky for being here. So I think it's helpful to view this in a long arc. This is the latest step in a five-year effort by the Obama administration to curtail abuse in education and training programs that are designed to prepare students for, quote, gainful employment, hence the name, after the students are done with their programs. The administration came out with a previous version in 2011, but that wound up being blocked by a federal court the next year, and the White House and the Education Department took another bite at the apple over the last 18 months. To some extent, the disagreement that you talked about whether these final rules are weaker or stronger, depends on what you're comparing them to. Administration officials make the case that these are stronger than the 2011 rules they came out with. They'd affect more programs, the 1,400 you mentioned, versus about fewer than 200 last time around, while consumer advocates and other critics of for-profit colleges are comparing these new rules, these new final rules, to a set of draft rules that were released in March, under which about 2,000 programs would have failed. So the biggest change from the draft rules was the elimination of a provision that would have held vocational programs accountable for their student loan default rates. Critics of for-profits say that dropping that standard would let programs off the hook if they enroll students who accumulate lots of debt and never graduate. Administration officials said they dropped the standard because they didn't believe it would be effective, and it was also opposed by community colleges and many consumer groups, as well as by for-profits. Two other quick points before we turn to Ben and Vicky for their insights from their perspective. There's a good chance that these rules end up being challenged both in court and potentially in Congress. Obviously, that depends in part on what happens next Tuesday's election. The administration has tried to do all it can to ensure that these rules don't suffer the same fate as last time in terms of getting blocked by a federal court, which may well have contributed to the demise of the default rate metric. And we can talk about this later, but I really think it's most useful to put this in the context of the administration's, to look over sort of the long haul, to put this in the context of the administration's overall campaign to rein in perceived abuses at for-profits, which I think sort of any objective analysis would show has been effective, whether you agree with the effort or not.
Vicky Charay at Bridgeport Education, what's your assessment of the lengthy regulations? I understand the document runs 945 pages.
Yes, and I'm still wading through them as we speak. I really want to reinforce Doug's point that it depends on what you're looking at. I mean, today we're talking about the difference between the NPRM and the final rule, but I think it is important to know there's significant changes from the 2011 rule to today, and that institutions, many, many institutions, took the original gainful employment rules seriously, put in place programs and practices to address those rules. If you look at the final rule, I think it's been widely reported the major change is the deletion of the programmatic cohort default rate metric. There was some debate. Doug mentioned that community colleges were against this metric. I think other institutions, other sectors may have supported it. There is some value in the desegregation of the cohort default rate by program and degree level as it starts to provide some insight into quality of programs that's not readily apparent at the institutional level. The other item that has changed, although I haven't had an opportunity to really dig in and understand what the implications are, was a change on the disclosure of licensure certification accreditation information for gainful employment programs. Again, it appears to be an expansion or a change from the NPRM, but it's still very early and we're trying to understand what that change is.
Ben Miller at the New America Foundation, do these changes represent real compromise or are they just part of a strategy that tries to protect the regulations from future legal challenges?
Well, you know, I think with any regulation of this length, you've got a lot of different things going on in different ways. You know, I think that the standards that are going to be applied now for graduates are unquestionably tougher than I think anything that's ever made it through to the final rule, largely because not only do schools have this failing status, but now they can be in this performance zone that basically says the acceptable threshold over the long run is now really 8% of the annual earnings compared to debt, or 20%, not the higher numbers of 12% or 30%. But, you know, the part that's a little bit hard to sort out is kind of as the department makes that change that's tougher, there's other changes that probably make the rule somewhat easier. In particular, they added this new transition period that, depending on the program length, you can either, for 5 or 7 years, use more recent debts of graduates. So basically, you would still use the earnings information from someone who graduated a few years ago, but you would take the debt amounts of a more recent graduate and make the comparison that way. And it's possible that that could actually result in a lot fewer programs getting tripped up than the estimated number. I think also, you know, the point Vicky makes is really important, that kind of there has been a lot of changes in the sector from the last time this effort occurred, and really one of the things that's important to remember when we're talking about all these numbers and figures and data is that they're really based upon graduates from 2008 and 2009. And so the extent to which companies have been making changes that are real and do actually manifest themselves in better improvements, it's entirely possible by the time we actually see the updated numbers that the failure rate could be substantially lower, not even necessarily because of a compromise, because of actual improvement.
Let's turn to the loan default rate, because taking that out of the new set of regulations seems to be a very big issue. Vicky, you alluded to that. Ben, you alluded to that. Vicky, let me come back to you at least to begin that conversation. How significant is it that the loan default rate is now gone?
You know, I think part of the significance is that we're now relying on basically one metric, the debt-to-earning metric. And, you know, as part of the negotiated rulemaking discussion, as part of the public comment period, there was a push to encourage, and it was the department's suggestion, to use the program cohort default rate. And there was suggestions and recommendations that the department utilize the program cohort default rate as possibly an alternative metric to debt-to-earnings to try to satisfy some of the concerns from community colleges and others. I think part of the challenge here is that, and maybe one of the reasons the department removed that, is there was fear, and I think Ben just alluded to it, about the quality of the data on the cohort default rate. I'm sure everyone is aware, it was widely reported again, that the department made some adjustments prior to the release of the recently published cohort default rate, and I think there was concern regarding inconsistent treatment of that data, inconsistent application and treatment of specific institutions. So there may have been some concern and angst over that.
Ben, is it a big deal that cohort defaults are no longer an operational metric in this conversation?
So I think in some ways it's not the cohort default, it's more sort of what the cohort default rate represented. You know, when you think about kind of problems in this space, there's really two issues. There's one of programs that really just do not pay off for graduates. They're either sort of too expensive versus what they're training people for, or for whatever reason that the folks aren't getting jobs that they're prepared for. Or there's another where you have a lot of programs where just not enough, too many people enter and not enough people graduate. And you know, I think the cohort default rate was important for capturing that other dynamic of sort of the dropout problem. I actually think it in the grand scheme of things, it's actually not the greatest measure out there, even setting aside the concerns that Vicky mentioned about, you know, some tweaks to it and changes to it due to concerns about the quality of servicing. You know, I think that the prevalence and ongoing publication and utilization of income-based payment plans is also going to eventually sort of blunt the importance of a default rate measure generally, just because, you know, if you're really struggling and that's why you're not repaying your loans, you in theory should be able to go on IBR, not make any payments, and then you can't default. So in some ways, over the long run, that measure is really going to only be telling you basically who's savvy enough to navigate the loan programs and get on an income-based plan. But I do have a little bit of concern over the long run, you know, as schools manage to hit these targets for their graduates, what does that mean in terms of caring about the dropouts?
And Doug, there's been some commentary that, in fact, the loan default metric was dropped to protect community colleges. Is that a fair critique?
Well, the community colleges were definitely unhappy with it. There was they were unhappy because the way, and again, I would probably defer to our other guests who study this, the actual rules language more closely than I do. But the way I understand it, the community colleges were really worried that they would be dinged, even though they have relatively few borrowers. Because in general, community colleges cost less, so fewer of their students borrow, and some of them actually don't let their students borrow. They don't participate in the federal loan programs. But they were really worried that they would be punished for very few defaulters, and we did a couple of stories that looked at the potential impact for a few schools. So they definitely opposed it, but during the process, even some of the consumer groups who are now complaining that the default rate disappeared, they were criticizing it as something that could be gamed. So there were a lot of people who didn't really want the default rate, and I just, like I said, I think Vicky made the point about sort of, we're talking about one metric here. I was about to say that I think the department tried to simplify. It's kind of hard to envision a 945-page rule having been simplified, but I do think that from a sort of protecting itself from a legal in the court standpoint, the simpler the better in terms of the number of moving parts and metrics. So I would suspect that played a role as well.
The landscape for the for-profits has changed dramatically in the last 5 or 6 years. Vicky, you've alluded to, and I think Ben alluded as well, that some of the early assessments were based on 2008-2009 data. In the last 5 or 6 years, we have seen enrollment rise, and then we've seen enrollment declines. Corinthian has collapsed. We have seen other for-profit providers close programs or close schools. Some of the regulations may have had an impact. There have been other things that have gone on in the economy as well. We have seen Grand Canyon University recently announced, and this is one of the most successful of the for-profits of late, where enrollments are still rising. It's a for-profit evangelical institution that it might be switching its status from for-profit to non-profit. What does the landscape look like going forward with these regulations or some tweaking to these regulations? Vicky, let me turn to you on this to begin.
Sure. While these regulations, obviously there has been a bias towards scrutiny regulations of this sector, but there have been an increase in the regulatory requirements of all institutions. I mean, the last 5 years, we've seen dramatic changes in the U.S. marketplace across all of higher education. So I would say it's not an issue just for the proprietary institutions. There are examples across the board of institutions, private nonprofits, failing to meet their enrollment targets at a significant level. There is a decrease in enrollment reported by the U.S. Census Bureau, again, across all institutions, all sectors. So there's a lot of shared pain in the higher ed space. When we talk about what institutions, and again, I go back to, I don't think it's just what proprietary institutions will survive, it's what institutions across all sectors will survive. I think we have to look at how institutions are approaching these requirements, how institutions are meeting the needs of our ever-changing student population. Are they providing innovative models, programs that meet their needs, that meet employer needs? Are they removing time and place constraints, again, to deal with this population of students, which is now, as we know, is what used to be called the non-traditional students? So I think it's an important question, but it is one that all institutions need to address.
And Ben, assuming that this set of regulations survives what seems to be an inevitable legal challenge, how does the landscape change as these things go into effect in July 2015?
Sure. So, you know, I think what we'll see probably is the continued kind of disaggregation of really the for-profit sector. You know, we talk a lot about how, you know, the for-profit sector this, the for-profit sector that, but it's really becoming increasingly clear that it's not a monolithic entity, even among sort of the large publicly traded ones. And, you know, I think what we saw in the past few years, kind of before a lot of the greater scrutiny, was basically when the economy goes south, it becomes much easier to find students to enroll and to kind of keep up profits and things of that nature, and that when the economy improves and enrollments start to decline, the places that are not doing as good of a job really start to get separated out from those that are doing better and are looking healthier. And so I think that's what we're seeing now. I mean, you know, I think it's not an accident that Corinthian was the first one to be in such a risky situation that a simple 21-day delay on its funding basically made it insolvent. You know, I think, again, it's not an accident to see which other ones are in that position, and at the same time to see the other companies that look a lot stronger, because I think those are the ones that have been more proactive in changing their practices and being smarter about what they're trying to do. So, you know, I think this rule will probably continue that pressure, especially because in general the shaky ones already look pretty shaky under this rule, and the good ones already look by and large good under this rule. So I anticipate that to probably continue, and then I think it's just a question of what does all the other efforts going on, either from the Department of Education, other federal agencies, or even, frankly, the investors at some of these places, due to the ones that look like they're teetering a bit.
And Doug Letterman at Inside Higher Ed, although the rules go into effect in July 2015, and there is the likelihood of an inevitable legal challenge, there's also political events on the calendar. We have an election next week. The Senate might turn from Democratic leadership to Republican leadership. There's a presidential election in 2016. How does the political calendar mesh against the implementation of these rules and the sustainability of these new regulations?
Well, so that's a fascinating question. I think a legal challenge is inevitable. I think we are likely to see Congress, especially if it's in fully Republican hands, take some shots at trying to undo this through riders to appropriations bills and other efforts. It's kind of hard to envision getting a veto-proof margin pretty hard to see something getting through President Obama, because I think it's in terms of whether the regulations survive, I think it's really likely going to depend on the presidential election in 2016. And that's the thing. This is a major, really going back to what I said in the opening, it's really hard to separate this, to not look at this from the perspective of the sort of long view. This has been a real major effort by this administration, and people can, have very different views about whether it was how philosophical it was, whether it is a sort of a philosophical objection to whether for-profit higher education is an oxymoron. There are, I think, you know, to take the administration at its word, or some of its officials at their word, this was really about sort of separating getting rid of some of the bad apples. And that was language that was used a lot in the early days, in the 2010s and 2011s, when this regulation was first coming through the pipeline. There has been, and people have referred to it earlier in this conversation, there has been a lot of change, and it's not all been driven by the regulation. A lot of it's been driven by the economy. It's been driven by Senate, the Democratic senators who have been pushing on this issue. We've seen states start to crack down. And we've seen a lot of institutions, a lot of the companies respond and make changes in who they're enrolling. What mostly drove this, there was some philosophical view, but there was also a view that the for-profits were just eating up increasing proportions of federal student aid and Pell Grant money. And I think I view what happened in 2009 and 10 as the administration's attempt to try to shift that money away from some of these institutions and to public institutions and community colleges. And I think we've seen some of that. I think we have seen the real significant changes in the for-profit higher ed market. And I think to a large extent, the administration, again, sort of looking, taking that long view, almost regardless of what happens with this rule, has succeeded in trying to change the behavior of some institutions in the sector and to sort of reduce its footprint in the market.
Vicki, has the administration, as Doug suggests, been successful in changing the behavior of individual proprietary institutions or the for-profit sector?
You know, I want to just add a slight caveat. You know, I would say this focus on at the national and federal level around a shift in federal policy and funding from access to success started before this administration, started in the Bush administration. And we began to see shifts in response to greater calls for accountability. And when the Obama administration, Secretary Duncan, came in, they actually continued that increased attention on success and accountability. Unfortunately, they tended to focus primarily on one sector of higher education, whereas if we really did care about accountability and student success, there are plenty of, as Doug calls it, bad apples across all sectors of higher ed, and we should look closely at that. I would like to add one other thing, just in terms of a business. A lot of what, in this new environment of student success, it's good business to promote and support student success and, more importantly, student satisfaction. So I think all of those things, obviously this regulatory environment maybe has pushed folks a little quicker than they may have originally planned to do. But again, I think there are a lot of factors that have resulted in kind of a change in focus and practice.
And Ben, whatever the outcome of these regulations in terms of legal challenges, a shift in Congress next week and a new presidential election, has the sector changed? Have the for-profits been affected as a permanent change in light of this particular initiative of the administration?
Well, I mean, permanent's a tough word. You know, in some ways, I think we actually see that this goes a little cyclical. You know, I think if you go back to the early 1990s, we were in some situations that mirror a lot of ones today in terms of kind of where the dollars are flowing and the results given for them. And, you know, the response in the 1990s was to introduce the cohort default rate that pared back, I think, several hundred institutions. I think that put a lot of schools sort of on better footing and made them sort of go the right direction for a while. And, you know, 15 plus years later, I think some of them started to lose their way. They sort of valued growth over anything else. And then, you know, we found ourselves in this situation again. So, you know, my hope is that this does result in a permanent sort of incentive shift and stays along. But, you know, we've also seen that, you know, initially good adaptations only stay that way for so long. And so, you know, I think it remains to be seen kind of what does this look like, you know, say the next time the economy declines and suddenly it is much easier to recruit students. You know, do you go again to focus on growth at any means, or do you stay on sort of the focus on quality and success?
Great. You know, many observers suggest that if we play a word analogy game, that gainful employment to the for-profits is as ratings to everybody else. Is that a fair analogy in terms of major initiatives from the administration? Vicki, let me turn to you on that.
You know, I don't believe it is an accurate analogy. Gainful employment was targeted at a specific set of institutions. And I think the argument from the sector has been if this is an important metric, a meaningful metric, should be applied across all institutions. And so, obviously, the voice you heard was a voice from the sector in opposition and also hoping to modify and improve the proposed gainful employment rule. Whereas the rating system, it's a system that's being applied to all. And so the resistance is quite loud, quite fierce from the traditional institutions and others. You're not hearing much from this sector. I think many companies, many institutions support transparency, support accountability, but the accountability, not only from the perspective of an equity, but also in terms of making sense to students and families, needs to apply to all institutions. If it doesn't apply to all, it doesn't lend itself to consumer information. It leads more to consumer confusion.
Ben, ratings versus gainful employment, are they similar, are they parallel, or as Vicky suggests, are they very different in terms of their reach and their impact?
I mean, I do think they're very different. You know, part of, I think, the challenge with the rating system right now is it's still been, you know, here we are more than a year after it was first announced, it's still an abstract exercise. And so I think that, you know, at a certain level, until you know exactly what it entails, it's something to be feared because it could be anything. And, you know, if you sit there and worry about sort of what might be in there, kind of any institution could theoretically be at risk because nobody knows what's going to go into the rating system and how they'll be rated. You know, I think with gainful employment, it was clear the whole time kind of at least what the metrics were, and then quickly became clear kind of what the results were as well. And I think that kind of gave a greater certainty and a greater sense of sort of how to argue against it and things like that. And I think with the ratings, the reason why I think we're hearing from more colleges at the moment at least is just that they really don't know what to expect and they don't know what's going to be in it. And I think once it becomes somewhat clearer, depending on what's in there, you'll either hear a lot of voices stay silent or you'll hear them get even louder because now they know exactly what they're dealing with. But until then, I think there's just a general sense of unease and dislike of the fact that what appears to be a very complicated exercise still has no details on it.
Doug Letterman at Inside Higher Ed, let me give you the last comment about gainful employment. There still seems to be, the regulations notwithstanding, a lot of ambiguity, a lot of uncertainty, an inevitable legal challenge, other political issues. What should we be looking at as it goes forward? What should we be looking back at to understand the context for gainful employment and the administration's efforts?
Well, I think the parallel I would draw between sort of the gainful employment and the rating system is that when Bob Shireman and the administration set out to sort of impose gainful employment back then, they framed it as part of a larger attempt to try to assure value in higher education, and then they came forward with gainful employment that, as Vicky said, really applied very narrowly to a set of institutions. It was mostly there were a lot of community colleges that were conceivably affected, but the vast impact was at for-profits, and I don't think that was accidental. I think the administration was really looking to make some headway in reining in for-profits, despite and gainful employment was a convenient way to do that. Having said that, now the reason I see a parallel between gainful employment and the rating system is that the rating system is an attempt, as I see it, gainful employment was an attempt to try to connect, to create a measure of value. It was a measure of cost or price or expenditure in terms of debt, and a measure of outcome in terms of earnings. I see the rating system, and again, Ben's right that we don't really know what it is yet and exactly, but ultimately it's about trying to come up with some kind of equation, and it's going to be a little more complex at places that are not purely vocational, but an attempt to try to define value, to come up with a set of measures that sort of say, is this institution adding value? Is it providing value to its students? So that's the way in which I see a parallel, is sort of applying this pressure to, this desire to try and prove and measure value to all institutions instead of just a relatively narrow band of vocational ones.
Great. That's our program for today. I want to thank Ben Miller at the New America Foundation, Vicky Shire at Bridgeport Education, and Doug Letterman at Inside Higher Ed for joining us for an engaging and thoughtful conversation. Our thanks to you, our audience, as well. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio stream or podcast on most Fridays. On the web, we are available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. Please share your thoughts about This Week with us on the comments section of the This Week webpage. Thank you for joining us.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.